I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Irene Hoffman. She's Philips Director and Chief Curator at Site Santa Fe, and Liz Armstrong, who's Curator of Contemporary Art at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. And they together have put together an amazing show called More Real, Art in the Age of Truthiness. It just opened at Site Santa Fe this past weekend. It runs through the rest of the year into the first week of January. And we're also joined by artist John Hirschend. He's a visual artist and filmmaker. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
Hi.
So Art in the Age of Truthiness, let's just start with the fact that truthiness is a word coined by the great Stephen Colbert. How did you guys come up with the idea of making a whole exhibition about this?
Well, we've already been talking about the murkiness of reality today. And that moment when Colbert coined the term truthiness was also the moment when more people started tuning into fake news for the real news than going to, you know, standard broadcast news. So it was kind of like the tipping point.
And of course, standard broadcast news not being exactly true.
There seemed to be that implication that people were running somewhere else to get real news. Yeah, and it sort of relates to that whole breakdown of credibility of journalism and a few other political offices and the kind of truth speakers we used to rely on. So we wanted to do something that looked at the kind of murk of that, but also how we all of us, but also artists, are exploring the underbelly of reality to get at these issues where fact and fiction collide.
And so the two of you kind of came up with this together?
This is a project that Liz actually has been thinking about for many years. I first heard about this idea from her when we both worked together at the Orange County Museum of Art, probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And if you think about Southern California, there's a lot that's more real in Southern California. And that really sparked this idea of a show that Liz has been thinking about since then. Colbert comes along in 2005 with truthiness, kind of gives a name to this phenomenon in the culture, and she moves on to the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, becomes their first contemporary curator, and that's where this show really starts to take shape. I come to Site Santa Fe 2 years ago, and about a year and a half ago, we started talking about bringing this show here in a really big way, teaming up her institution with Site Santa Fe to realize her vision on a very grand scale.
And grand scale it is. You filled the entire Site Santa Fe with all kinds of art, and maybe we could talk, I want to talk about some of the pieces, and John, your video and everything, which is very interesting, but truth and lies in art go way back. I mean, we have seen, where is it in Italy, where there's what looks like the inside of a cathedral dome, but it's actually just a painted flat board because they didn't have enough money to actually finish the dome. I mean, trompe l'oeil, fooling the eye. That's as old as art itself.
Classical. Yeah, but I think what's interesting now is that once we realize that it took satire and kind of fakeness to get to the truth in the body of these fake news shows, this interest in artifice to speak the truth became really relevant again. You know, I think art had become very much about art, and here's work that's very political that actually is complicit with truthiness itself to expose this factor in our society.
I suppose, I mean, it's such a terrific show because it is so relevant to this big elephant in the middle of the living room, which is that our politicians are continually lying to us, and there is a culture of lying that is a kind of media state collaboration, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It is the elephant in the room. I mean, that's a good way to put it. And there are certain works in the show that take that on head on, the Phantom Truck being maybe the kind of ground zero of the exhibition.
Tell us about that piece.
So this is a piece by Inigo Manglano Avalle that was inspired, if that's the right word, by Colin Powell's statement to the UN Security Council about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that led to the invasion of Iraq. And Inigo wanted to basically fabricate a fabrication. So it's sort of this deception exposed by the real two-scale refabrication of something that probably never existed.
So these trucks, which were supposed to expose a truth that was in fact a lie, never existed. So he fabricates a truck and puts it in a dark room.
kind of the shadow reality that impacted and had a huge real impact on thousands of lives.
And to make the artwork, he used the very blueprints and photographs and drawings that were presented to the UN Security Council. He used the evidence, quote-unquote evidence, to then make this artwork. And when you walk in the room, it you don't see it at first.
Right.
You sense it. Right. You really sense it. And as your eyes adjust, this phantom becomes real.
Now, do all of you remember actually seeing that in 2003?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you remember your reaction to it when Colin Powell said this stuff about weapons of mass destruction and here's the evidence and pointing at this?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of us already knew that there was this fabrication going on. And what was shocking was that so many journalists seemed to go along with it. At least that's my memory.
Well, it was Colin Powell, too. I mean, he was someone who... I was very dubious of the whole administration, but I thought, well, maybe this guy is honest. And I felt like he was set up for that as well.
Yeah.
And I felt sorry for him.
What about you?
Well, I recently, even recently seeing him, on Bill Maher, even sort of talk about another one of these kinds of news programs.
Right.
Talking about that moment and the regret that he felt about that his role.
Having been set up to lie and going along with it. I mean, I remember the moment that happened, and I was watching television, and I looked at his body language, and I knew he was lying. And then I see everybody else printing this, and everybody else believing it, and these journalists believing it, and thought, why is it that I would bet my life that this man is lying, and everybody else is buying into it? And this is the age that we live in.
And this is why I would say that, like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who specialized in these fake news shows, are really like public intellectuals. Like in their way, through satire, through very intelligent satire, they are they're taking it on, you know, taking on this issue of duplicity and you know, have this incredible moral compass to make us understand how complicit we can be in this too if we don't question it.
Exactly. Don't question it and don't actually challenge it and do our best to put the truth out there and demand the truth from the media, such as we are now. How did you then go about choosing the various artists? I mean, you just told us about this one piece, the Phantom Truck. There's so many other pieces in the show that get at this issue from many different directions.
And, you know, I think that I started with certain artists and artworks that I felt had to be in the show, but the challenge has been that to really deal with this issue and not just scratch the surface, I wanted to play with all the ways that we manipulate reality. And one is, you know, what you referred to, which is the nature of art, which is trompe l'oeil, and playing with the deception of something appearing to be something it's not. And I definitely wanted some of that, but I didn't want the show to just be that. And then clearly the impact of film and video and digital technologies has allowed us all to manipulate reality very easily. So absolutely wanted that to be a component. And then there's this truthiness parafiction element, and that's where maybe John comes in. This, you know, adopting another persona or another fake identity to speak the truth. Now, in John's case, Irene and I both also were looking at, you know, how do you do an informational kind of piece that leads people into a sort of complex subject? And we found out that he did these wonderful works in which deceptions were layered on deceptions, but which started out as very straightforward factual pieces. So it fit perfectly, we thought, with what was the undercurrent of the show, but kept it light.
Now, your piece, John Hirschman's, is supposedly a promotional video for this exhibition, More Real, and at the same time, it kind of devolves into something else.
Yeah, the setup for it is to be very straightforward when you walk in, and the viewer would see this as my ideal was that they had hired the wrong person to make this promotional video. Like, A, it was a bad idea, and then somehow it got through, and then B, this person who made this promotional video completely hijacks the video in the process of making it with his own issues.
Right.
Which, to go back to, I think a lot of the work that I've been doing over the past 10 years is related to, I mean, even though it's not political overtly, it's related to when Bush won the second time against Carrie.
Quote one.
Yeah, yeah,
unquote.
Yeah. And I right, exactly. And I really thought I knew the country. It was like almost like it was a breakup, like with a girlfriend. The country went the other way, and I thought, how can they do this? This is insane. And so I really got into the idea of making works that take on black and white, you know, facts, utilizing PowerPoint presentations, informational videos, infomercials, and then putting in the murky reality that we all deal with. I mean, our realities are messy, you know, and we want structure, but the structure is just laid on top. The reality is just completely a mess. So that's what this video is after.
Right.
And I love the reminder of that factor of our realities, which is that even though we can manipulate film and images and, you know, all of the sophistication of technology and what it provides us, in the end, you sit across from the tables with someone else who you think you know well, mm-hmm. and then suddenly you realize, I don't know this person. You know, I mean, there's just that basic sense of our own realities being very much trapped in ourselves and how much we have to create a reality to even get through every day. So it's a really complex, wonderfully slippery subject.
Yeah, indeed. And the whole kind of format of an informational video kind of reminds you that the form of whatever you're watching at kind of cues you about mm-hmm. how to react to it. So it's like, oh, this is a product video. I'm about to get some information about a product, and you tune your mind to receive that kind of information, and you kind of tune out anything else that might be more subtle, and then John Hirschend kind of pulls the rug out from under our feet, which is nice.
No, that's the idea. I think that, you know, they're ready-mades, these forms of video that are out there. Even documentary or Hollywood feature film, we know what to expect from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I think it's really great to pull someone into that and then slowly subvert or put in my own agenda.
Exactly.
And take
it where I want. Those few documentaries that don't follow the documentary form are very interesting. Because
Sherman's March is one. Sorry to interrupt,
but that's an
amazing one. Where
exactly.
He's setting out to follow Sherman's March, but he ends up getting his deal with his girlfriend and breakups and other girlfriends along the way, and it just becomes about that.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, and also, I mean, I saw, and now I don't remember the name, but at the Santa Fe Art Institute, there was a video about some people in Mexico, and it moved as slowly as their actual real pace of life. Mm. And so instead of being something that moves at the pace of a documentary, it moved at the pace of the people whom you're trying to learn about, and you realize how rarely you see that.
Yeah. No, it's incredible.
You know, I think we're so inundated with information and details and emails, and that one thing great art does is to slow us down and take us a little bit by surprise, because we do assume a lot of things, even if we're self-questioning kind of people. You still fall into your assumptions, and what the works in this show do almost consistently is make you take a double take and ask you to think again about what you assume to be true.
We're talking about More Real, Art in the Age of Truthiness, the exhibition at Site Santa Fe. Irene Hoffman, tell us about some of the other pieces in the show.
Well, John's orientation video is just one of the works that represent a new commission in this larger show. Also in the lobby space, when you walk into Site, first you'll see the orientation video space of John's video. But on the wall you'll see an amazing, very subtle work by Mary Temple. And talk about trompe l'oeil. This is a piece that, in my experience of our audience already, many people miss it when they first walk in. It is she calls them light installations, and it looks like sunlight on the walls. A shadow of the window mullions, trees that might be across the street, but none of it is real or possible. It's probable if you're not really paying attention. But once you notice it, you realize that there is no projection of light, it isn't sunlight, and it's all just painted on the wall. So that's another one of the newly commissioned works specifically for the exhibition. And the other one greets you even before you walk in, and that is a major architectural intervention by the Los Angeles-based architect Greg Lynn. You will see the start of it as you drive past Site. You'll see he has created an entrance portal and a view into the space that really is a rupture from not only the surface and the shape of our warehouse building in brown adobe, but it also has this very bright kind of color that really signals the entrance portal. And we went to him and asked him to think about creating a space that might be a little disorienting. And he started talking about, well, what would happen if there was something wrong with gravity right at that spot when people walk in, and what would happen if the wall started to try to pull away. And so you will see as you enter the space and as you move right into the first galleries that he has created this intervention that not only frames your entrance into the space, but your view into several other galleries, sort of adding to the disorienting nature of a number of works that greet you right when you come in the building.
It reminds me of the people who are trying to teach media literacy to young people. As you look at how people are playing with your minds, you get to actually understand that so that they're not as able to play with your minds the next time.
Yeah, I mean, and it's something that younger people may well be more attuned to, but I feel like all of us, there's always going to be new technology that tricks and deceives. And so it's, again, the show is very much about that mind cast of questioning and understanding the difference between what's real and what isn't.
Now, there's a wonderful artist named Dario Robleto who's done a couple of pieces that maybe you can describe to us a little bit.
Well, I can tell you, on the front wall in the first gallery, there's a pair of battered-looking boxing gloves. And I guess at first glance, it looks like Dario might have found these things. They're quite exotic in how beat up they are. But when you read the materials he uses, they are really part of the piece. So these gloves are like reverse ready-mades. They look like they were found, but they're actually handcrafted very carefully. And he's a bit of an alchemist. So I can't remember all the materials, but there's broken male hand bones. There's pigment, rust, and there's pieces of an LP record called The Titanic, which is about the bad, the good luck, ironic luck, of blacks who were barred from being on the doomed ship. So he takes all these materials that embody this object, and he also gave it a title, which is The Melancholic Refuse to Surrender. So do you know what I mean? So he's like a poet of the real to me.
And there was a real boxer whose boxing gloves those were modeled after who was refused entrance onto the Titanic because he was black, and next thing you know, the Titanic sinks, and you can only imagine the mix of emotions that somebody in that position would feel. But the other thing I was thinking, I mean, so there's remnants of a vinyl record which has a song, which is about this, which is embedded in the object that you're seeing. And it made me think about relics, like the veil of this or that saint. You look at it and it's a piece of cloth, but your connection to what it actually means is something that you cannot tell from looking at it. And it sort of makes you wonder about a question that I don't really know how to answer, which is what kind of power or vibe is actually held in objects.
Yeah, I mean, there is the reality of symbolic objects. And one of the pieces in the show that I've already seen people gravitating to is a whole archive about a theme park that was being planned in Coney Island by the Coney Island Amateur Psychoanalytic Group. And
no.
All their archives, films of them, their plans for this theme park based on Freud's interpretation of dreams. And people are fascinated by the comic books that they, you know, worked on, and the wax museum that was found upstairs on top of a kind of freak show in Coney Island. And the relic is a very important aspect of reality because it isn't really that thing, but it embodies our memories, our beliefs. And I think in a way that's what great art, that's its power. It can embody whole complex ideas and feelings and moments in history.
We're talking about More Real at Site Santa Fe, which just opened this past weekend. Now, I have in my hands right now a More Real Guide to Santa Fe, which has in it some things that are true and some things that are not true.
Yes, this was a project that represents a collaboration of many of the staff at Site. you know, as we were thinking about more real here in Santa Fe, the show has this quality of really making you look at so many things in your life differently, right? And so that really made us think about the place we are and looking at the buildings around us, and there's so much that is more real about this place we live. And so this is a tribute to the exhibition. It's a tribute to Santa Fe. And half of the things on this walking tour that starts at site, half of them are real, and the other half are more real. And
so more real means not real.
Not so real. Not so real. But
so every time, ladies and gentlemen, every time in this interview that Irene has said more real, she means not real. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
So you can pick up a copy of the More Real Guide to Santa Fe at site and take an alternative tour of a town that maybe you thought you knew. And this is sort of another take on that. We studied all of the different tours, the official tours that happen here in Santa Fe, and made our very own.
You should get these into all the hotels.
We should. We should.
Brilliant.
So let's see, anything else that you guys want to let us know about? I mean, we don't want to talk about every single piece in the show because we are encouraging people to go discover it.
Well, I just want to add that, yes, more real can mean not real, but it really can mean more real, because what do we mean by real? And, you know, one of the great, there's several pieces from Second Life, you know, a virtual world that you enter through an avatar. Well, who's to say that's not more real when you enter that world? Maybe you create an identity that actually is more true to your own personal reality. So I really also want a show that kind of opens us up to that sort of meditation.
And to the meditation that a lot of people in Santa Fe are in, namely the kind of cliche, you make your own reality.
Is that big here?
Oh, yes. And, I mean, if that's the case, then I created Poughkeepsie, which is where I was born, which I'm not so sure about.
Or Schenectady. But, of course, we do. And that's what's, you know, just to tie it back to John's film, it seems real, and then it seems even more real when the camera's back away. And there are all those different sides of ourself. I mean, I'm playing myself in it, but I was more real.
Yeah, definitely.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, all of this is a wonderful opportunity for people to think and respond. And I always encourage people to go with their friends and talk about.
It's a great talking show.
And I want to thank you all for being here with us. Liz Armstrong is Curator of Contemporary Art at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. Irene Hoffman is Phillips Director and Chief Curator at Site Santa Fe. John Hirschend is visual artist and filmmaker, and More Real Art in the Age of Truthiness goes until January 6th of the coming year, which is Epiphany.
And then it comes to Minneapolis.
And then it goes to Minneapolis.
We'll take on another reality.
Very interesting. Well, thank you all so much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
And we are talking this segment about Art Fest 12. Which is an event sponsored by the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, whose president, Larry Hines, is joining us, as well as John Rodriguez, who's the Director of International Student Experience, and Lauren Eichmann, who's the PR manager. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
So Art Fest it's the first time that you've done it, is that correct?
That's right. This is the first of what we hope will be many Art Fests here in Santa Fe over the summer.
And it's a whole series of events that the community can take part in. You have some art workshops that go over 3 weeks all day long, so it's like going to serious intensive art camp. You have two-hour kind of standalone workshops, and you've got some evening events.
That's correct.
Tell us about some of the long workshops. They sound very interesting.
Well, I think there's two major premises to the event. One is we wanted to get the community onto campus to see what we're doing and to experience what our students have been experiencing, which is really special. And then the other element of it, we wanted to invite the world to Santa Fe, which we've done with our sister schools around the world, the Laureate International Universities Network. So we have over 200 folks coming from 11 or 12 countries around the world, including faculty and students. And then we've been out advertising and promoting these events in the local community because we're trying to drive as many local community members onto campus as well.
So you've got people coming from, can you explain to people, because maybe they don't know how your kind of network of schools works.
Sure. So Santa Fe University of Art and Design joined the Laureate International University's network about 2.5 years ago.
That was when the College of Santa Fe ceased to be and then was kind of taken over by Laureate.
And College of Santa Fe morphed into what is now Santa Fe University of Art
right.
and Design.
And some of the same people are still there. It's on the same right. campus.
Curriculum is pretty much consistent. The faculty members, the chairs, and even some of our students are carryovers from College of Santa Fe. And we joined this international universities network that has over 60 universities in 30 countries around the world. And many of those have art and design programs. So we've spent the last 2.5 years connecting within that university with schools in Italy, New Zealand, Turkey, Mexico, Brazil, etc. And so those are the schools we've reached out to and have invited their students and their faculty to get a taste of the U.S., number one, and number two, enjoy Santa Fe over the summer.
Right.
So.
Now, some of the specific workshops that you are going to be giving or offering have to do with animation, architecture, film, art, photography, so many different things. Which ones are the really long, intensive ones, and who do you expect to go to those? Because, what is that, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday for 3 weeks?
It's just about that.
Yeah.
It's pretty intensive. Enough for our students to earn credit. So it is
okay.
very intensive. But the community members are invited to join and participate as well. They won't be earning credit, but it is a pretty intense project-based set of workshops that are 3 weeks solid, Monday through Friday.
What are some examples of those?
So one of the intensive workshops is called Icon Words. It's taught by a faculty member from Milan, Italy, from a school called NABA. And it's about fonts and iconic words. Another one is Myth of the City, which is taught by a faculty member from New School Architecture and Design from San Diego who's coming in to teach that. One that's particularly interesting for folks if they haven't experienced northern New Mexico in a big way is Natives to Nukes. And that's a history of the Southwest with specific tours to Taos, Los Alamos, Bandelier. And it literally is Native American history to nuclear history in northern New Mexico. So that's really exciting. And Robert Jensen is the faculty member teaching that.
Nice. Excellent. And then what are some of the one-day ones? Those are more likely that people who aren't who are working full-time or mostly full-time will be able to take them.
And that was by design. We recognize that not everybody has 3 weeks that they could show up Monday through Friday for.
Wish we did.
I know. That would be a nice life.
Somebody was here the other day, and their son was going to camp. And I just thought, how wonderful. we adults should be able to go to camp every once in a while.
Exactly. That's right. Well, the lighter workshops, I'll call them that, elective workshops, range from a number of things. We've got. One title is Auditions and Interviews, Strategies for Maintaining Authenticity and Rising Above the Crowd. So it's folks in the performing arts to get trained on how do you go to an audition, how do you present yourself, how do you survive the interview that goes on before and after the auditions. That's taught by Lisa Hamilton, who's an alum of the school and is also an employee of the school. We've got tour with the curator, the contemplative landscape at the New Mexico History Museum. So this takes place at the New Mexico History Museum. It's taught by Marianne Redding, who's the chair of our photography
nice.
Department. I'll just give you a couple other titles. Exploring the Patterns and Shapes of Nature as Design. Sculpting.
Oh, that's Maggie McNabb.
That's right.
We had her on the air. She's
okay.
brilliant. She's absolutely amazing. She wrote a book by that name.
Yeah, that's an exciting one. Sculpture, Learning to Love You More, which is taught by Kate Carr, a Foundation's faculty member at the school. Recreate an object from someone's past. How can you describe a significant object from your past? So storytelling in a creative way. A personal studio tour by Suzanne York, who's a faculty member in our art department. So you get to go to her studio where she does these large-scale graphite installations.
That's right.
So that looks really cool. We've got collective consciousness, the art collective phenomenon, which is taught by members of the Meow Wolf collective. And they'll talk about the evolution of the group and the history of the group and how it came to be.
They're amazing.
The last one I'll mention is a workshop called Catching the Soul, which is different aspects of portrait photography. It's taught by a faculty member from Germany, one of our sister schools called BTK, Katrin Thomas. And that they have a great photography program. So those photographers in town that want to get a different perspective might look into that.
And I hear there's a salsa dancing event.
We put that on there just for you, Mary Charlotte, because I understand you enjoy salsa dancing. But
yes, just a little.
For the community, is invited onto campus. It's a social event that obviously includes salsa dancing, and I would check the website for time and confirmation.
Excellent. John Rodriguez, you're the director of International Student Experience. What does that mean?
Well, I pretty much take care of the students from the minute they accept their offer to Santa Fe University of Art and Design to the minute they leave. So my office really looks over the student. We almost become that parent for the students. We make sure, first and foremost, they have a successful academic semester and that they have a great student experience in between with our programs, our activities, our residential life programs.
What percentage of your students are from other countries?
Well, currently we have our student our international student population is about, say,
typically it's been about 20%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of the overall student body, and that's the target that we aim for.
Yeah.
Right.
We'll maintain.
And do they mostly come from Latin America? Or?
Majority from Latin America. We've had students from Spain. We've had students from quite a few from Mexico, quite a few from Brazil. Two from Turkey so far, Istanbul, Turkey. We have a school there. So kind of a smattering from other countries, and we're really working on that now to really pull in more students from other than Latin America.
So there's a lot of Spanish and Portuguese presence on campus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How does that like come out in daily life?
It works well. You know, we do have an English requirement for the students when they come to Santa Fe, but it's great. It really adds to the student overall student experience. Our domestic students then have an opportunity to meet students from around the world, maybe learn a different language. By the time these students leave, our domestic students have made friends and they have invitations to stay at their homes in their countries. And
right.
It's just really cool to see how they all mix together and really what it brings to the campus, overall campus community.
And what kind of offerings do you have in the evenings for those of us who like to just go out and go to performances and stuff at night?
Well, the first one, Mary Charlotte, I think you'll be interested in, is Shakespeare on the Quad. So every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 20th, 21st, 22nd.
Oh, we just talked to them yesterday.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you got the you have more background than I do. So I should interview you on
the
that.
The Shakespeare Society of Santa Fe is presenting A Midsummer Night's Dream, and they seem absolutely brilliant.
There you go. From 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock on the Quad every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday during Art Fest. It's free for the public. And with weather permitting, it should be wonderful events for the community. Second one I'm really excited about is the screening of Chris Ayer's new movie called Hideaway.
Yeah, and we'll be talking to him soon, too.
That's great. So real quick background on Chris. Chris is the chair of our moving images or film department. Terrific filmmaker in his own right. Has won Sundance. This film is a somewhat quieter film than what others that he's done in the past, but it proves to be really effective. James Cromwell is in it. Who's the other actor?
Josh Lucas.
And that is on July 20th at 7 p.m. at the screen. And Chris will be giving a kickoff discussion about how the film came to be from his side. And then the last one, Deep Listening Concert, is at O'Shaughnessy on Wednesday, July 18th from 10 p.m. to midnight. So maybe for the crew who likes to stay out later at night. And that's a series of performances by our faculty and alumni in the garage at O'Shaughnessy, which is in Benildis Hall. So just several events that we hope the community comes out and spends time on the campus.
Excellent. The website for ArtFest 12 is artfest12.com. The number's 12, not the word 12 spelled out. Artfest12.com. Anything that anyone wants to add before we go?
I'd say further contact, depending on how people want to get in touch with us. Lauren, your phone number?
Mm-hmm. My phone number is 505-473-6440. And you can also register a few different ways, either through our website for the primary workshops. You can register online, artfest12.com. Or if you're interested in a one-day elective morning workshop, you can send an email to artfest12@santafeuniversity.edu.
And ArtFest 12 is July 16th through August 3rd. Larry Hines is president of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And John Rodriguez is the director of International Student Experience. And Lauren Eichmann is PR manager. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the show Margaret Wood. She's a writer. Her most recent book is Remembering Miss O'Keefe, Stories from Abiquiu. And tonight at 6 o'clock, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore in conversation with poet Miriam Sagan. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you, too. So how did you, at the age of 24, end up in Abiquiu working for Georgia O'Keefe?
I had an acquaintance who had the same work as a caregiver for Miss O'Keefe, and she was about to leave. She was wondering who could do this remarkable job for this elderly, incredible painter, and I was an acquaintance, so she called me to see if I'd be interested in working for Georgia O'Keefe and living in a small northern New Mexico village, and I said yes.
And so were you like a wide-eyed young fan kind of thing?
I was. I was wide-eyed and intimidated by this famous particular person.
And so what was it like when you first went there to be interviewed?
Well, Miss O'Keefe was very quiet. She and her business manager, Juan Hamilton, interviewed me. And Miss O'Keefe just said, "Can you cook?" And I said, "Yes, I can cook." And, "What do you like to cook?" And I said, "I like to cook very healthy food." She was pleased with that. She didn't say very much, but they were just very interested in the fact that I would move to the little village near Abiquiu and work with Miss O'Keefe most days of the week.
And so you were kind of working the night shift.
Yes, uh-huh.
Did you have to stay up all night?
No, I could sleep, and that was a nice thing. I went at 5 o'clock in the evening. I fixed a supper with Miss O'Keefe. In the summer, we could go out and pick the food from the garden and then have what we wanted for supper. Then we might go for a walk in the circular driveway, or if we were at Ghost Ranch, start a little walk to the cliffs, and then come back, maybe listen to music, and I would read to her things of her choice, and then she would go to bed and I could go to sleep as well, and we'd rise at 6 for breakfast.
Now, what was she like? You say in the book that her eyesight was failing.
That's right. She had macular degeneration, so her central vision was not good at all. So she needed someone around her so she would be safe. As far as her personality, she was extremely particular and not unfriendly about it, but very demanding about how she liked things done. Everything from the way her food was fixed to the way maybe the rooms were cleaned and arranged, or the way that I brushed her hair.
Right. How did the eyesight problem, you say in your memoir that she recognized you by the way that you walked but couldn't really see your face. She was still painting at the time.
That's right.
How could she paint?
She had this, I wrote this quote that she had been talking to a friend on the telephone, and she said, "If you really know what you're doing, you don't have to see." But she,
it's like Beethoven composing when he's deaf or something.
But she had these abstract paintings that she worked on in her 90s, and they were simple enough that she worked with the shading of certain areas and just simple colors and values to make abstract paintings quite lovely.
And you helped her a little bit with some of the
painting.
Canvases?
With one painting, yes. Uh-huh. Just the parts that were a solid color. And she instructed on the way the brush should be moved, on the way the strokes should go. But she worked with the areas that were shaded. And when she was, when it became controversial that she had used assistance for her painting, she gave a quote to, I think it was Art News, that the assistants were merely palette knives. It was her idea, and the idea was what was important.
We're talking to Margaret Wood about her book, Remembering Miss O'Keefe, Stories from Abiquiu. because Georgia O'Keeffe was so well known at that time, she was already, what, well into her 80s, almost 90?
Oh, she was 90 when I, well, 89 when I met her, so soon 90. So I worked with her from the time she was 90 to 95.
Uh-huh. And she was, at that point, famous, kind of iconic. Were there, what would you call them, sort of fans and art people showing up all the time?
Well, people had to make appointments, and so certain people did receive an appointment. Other people arrived and knocked on the gate, and generally she would not see them, but now and then she would see someone who was at her window or at the gate to see their adored Georgia O'Keeffe. Not often, though.
Right, and so... And there were a few, like you met, who was it, Allen Ginsberg?
That's right. And Joni Mitchell, and this South American artist named Marisol. So there were a few people I met. But on the weekends and on the evenings, there were very few guests.
Did she talk about her past with you? I mean, did you guys form kind of a friendship where she told you things?
I feel we had a friendship. And she did. She talked about her past quite a bit. She would tell lovely stories about her youth or her time in New York or her earlier times in New Mexico in her very colorful, unique language.
What did she say about Stieglitz, her husband who died in, I think it was 1945?
She would talk about him very fondly. Sometimes she spoke about what his interests were, and one of my stories in the book describes that he was interested in the horse races rather than in the arts page. She spoke about their time at Lake George and how he would like to go out in the canoe and how his mother would stand on the porch worried because she knew he didn't know how to swim.
Now, the book is full of black and white photographs. Are they all from that time?
They're my father's photographs. When I was working with Georgia O'Keeffe, my father received permission to photograph a few occasions at both the Abiquiu and the Ghost Ranch House.
And so those are his pictures from that time.
They are, uh-huh. They're from a book which is now out of print called O'Keeffe at Abiquiu.
Now, do you ever go back to her house, which is now a tourist place?
I do. I enjoy taking the tour every now and then, and I like a couple of the people who... I'm friends with a couple of the people up there, and of Judy Lopez, who's the manager and director up there. Yes.
Do you feel like it... Does it feel the same as when you were there when she was living there?
In a certain way, yes, and of course, no. But in an uncanny way, yes, because they've kept it so carefully as she left it.
How did the time that you spent taking care of Georgia O'Keeffe influence your life? I mean, you were there in a kind of formative time in your 20s. What did you do next?
Definitely. Well, I felt like I wasn't very guided for a while, but what I've ended up as my profession is speech pathology, and I really enjoy working with older people, so I think she influenced me in that way. I also know that she influenced the way I enjoy food and cook food, and that I've participated in a garden recently, and that experience has been good. Also in the way I keep my environment in part, some parts of it rather sparse as hers.
Very interesting. Margaret Wood's new book is called Remembering Miss O'Keeffe, Stories from Abiquiu. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock in conversation with Miriam Sagan. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, I just appreciate your interviewing me today. Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you so much, Margaret Wood. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Stephen Jules Rubin. He's producer of Santa Fe's monthly variety show, and he's a performer in that. And Tone Forrest, he's an actor, musician, and host of the variety show. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for welcoming me.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And so this is now becoming an institution, this monthly variety show. We hope.
We hope, yes.
You started it a few months ago.
Yeah, this is number four, refused to miss a month, and hope to carry it on forever.
So what can we expect in this variety show, which, by the way, is happening Sunday, July 15th at 7 in the evening at Warehouse 21?
Correct. Well, if anyone's seen the past ones, this one will be sort of, the flyer says, show of short bursts. Some of the other shows have had longer theatrical pieces and such. This one is a lot of short numbers. There's some great musician this time, a short dance piece, poetry, some short plays, a comedy. But definitely much more variety.
Is this the first one, Tone, that you've participated in?
Yes, I attended the first one, and I was impressed both by the performance and by the effort to create something ongoing. The idea of doing a monthly theater salon is an idea that I've had for years, and I'm glad that Jules here has been able to pull it off, or is still trying to pull it off.
Trying to pull it off, yeah. We've
I know how hard it is.
It is hard. It's hard, particularly without, you know, the ability to you know, have financial backing or anything. Doing it for the love of it is great, but it does make it more challenging, and you know, certain people can commit and then something else comes up. But
right.
But I know everybody really, it's obviously a great idea that obviously, you know, isn't particularly mine, but we are the ones getting it going. But
yeah. And so, I mean, part of what's tricky about this is, I mean, there's certainly lots of theater people in town, but getting a whole bunch of people to do a short thing and getting somebody else to perform it, it's all for free.
It's all for free.
And, you know, getting them to rehearse it, using whatever profit. Basically, it's producing a whole bunch of theater pieces,
yeah,
albeit small.
Right.
Purely for the love of it.
Right. And my friends that I forced to help, you know, particularly Steve Rammel, who's helping with sound, and other people still need somebody this month that can really help with the lights. But, you know, it's Steve Rammel has been calling it the seat of the pants production, which as much as I may try for that not to happen, again, as we're saying, at this level, it just happens. Somebody commits and can't, and et cetera.
That's a good title for a production company.
Seat of the pants. We used to use Wasted Talent Productions, but we've grown up now.
what are some of the highlights of this month's variety show?
Well, there's two short plays, and unfortunately, Elena, if you're listening, they are readings. It's just, as you say, it's hard to get people to rehearse and prepare off book. But Jules Works has been doing a serialized one each month. So I know we have at least one person who's participating now, Jody Drinkwater, who's been following us month to month. So there's a continuity in that, although I knew all along that the following would happen, which is some actors come and go. But it's light, goofy, funny, but with philosophical undertones, hopefully.
Sounds like you.
Yes, yes. And then the play Jody wrote, for anyone who saw last month with Michael Weavers, which was a lot like mine, although I had nothing to do with that, this one is, she's a very distinctive voice. Of, you know, you can see she reads a lot of Sam Shepard. But yeah, Tone. We have a great musician, Jonathan Hill, thanks to Tone, and I'm excited about that. We had a band 1 month, but we haven't really had solid, great music yet, and that's important. I want that for this month and to carry on, some musicians that can be there.
So you are looking for, because this is a monthly variety show, you're looking for people for next month, too, for the August monthly variety show.
Right.
And how can they contact you?
My email, which I could spell out, srubinfilms@gmail, srubinfilms@gmail. And in the Facebook age, if you just connect with Santa Fe's Monthly Variety Show, that's probably an easier way to connect with me
yeah,
and let me know what you have. Last month, we only had 3 weeks. This time, we will have 5 weeks to get the next one together. But there are some slots for folks.
And you're looking for basically any kind of theater or readings of original work. You people can do dance, poetry,
music,
anything that's performing arts.
It's
of some
pretty
kind.
Open, you know. And also, one thing that's neat is I've been offering anyone with a production going on to promote that show.
The first performance that I witnessed, there was a gentleman there who had gone to the trouble of memorizing the first 5 chapters of James Joyce's Ulysses.
I know
Finnegan's
who that
Wake.
Must be.
Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, it was Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Even more obscure. Adam Harvey, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he recited one of the chapters.
It's an ongoing thing, I guess.
Oh, my Lord.
He is a force of nature.
It's, you know,
is
the
he
passion.
Back?
Not this month, no.
Okay.
I'll be opening the show with a Lord Buckley piece. For those who don't know him, he was brilliant.
And yes.
Before his time. And it's going to be Jonah and the Whale.
And one consistency each month is a host that guides the night. And so for this month, I'm very happy that Tone Forest will be that host.
Stephen Jules Rubin and Tone Forest, Santa Fe's monthly variety show this Sunday, the 15th of July at 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21 Black Box Theater. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us.
Thank you for supporting.